previously.tv podcast network.
If I may be so bold, sir.
I see the paper has gone up again. I'm going to cancel my subscription.
No, sir.
Well?
It would appear from the paper that your grandson has been kidnapped.
I am perfectly capable of reading, Bullimore.
Of course, sir.
The butter is too hard.
Big name heirs J. Paul Getty III and Patty Hearst were kidnapped within 8 months of each other in the mid-70s, and people have been questioning their respective levels of victimization and participation ever since. Did Getty want his ransom money for himself? Was Hearst brainwashed or an active and organized participant in the SLA's crimes? And is Toby Ball going to quit mid-record when I try to tie the decade together with a grand unifying theory involving D.B. Cooper? Lend an ear, not J. Paul Getty III's, to The Blotter Presents, episode 49. Welcome back, everybody. This is The Blotter Presents, previously.tv's take on all things TV true crime. I am your host, Sarah D. Bunting. Thank you for your patience during my birthday week off. I am joined once again by Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
I'm like the guest that wouldn't leave.
Bless your heart. So this week in our most wanted section, we are discussing Trust, which is FX's limited edition series, although who knows with these things, they might franchise this one as well. The first episode, as we're recording this, has just aired on Sunday the 25th. It's 10 episodes. Here is the case file. In July of 1973, J. Paul Getty III, Balthazar's father, and the grandson of notoriously parsimonious oil magnate J. Paul Prime, was kidnapped by a consortium including members of the Calabrian Mafia. Famous original J. Paul refused initially to pay the ransom, whether from native cheapness, unwillingness to endanger his other grandchildren by appearing to negotiate with terrorists, or the not-minority opinion suspicion that Triple Sticks had engineered his own napping to pry loose some spending money. When one of Paul's ears showed up in the mail, Prime caved. And when American Crime Story showed FX how firmly prestige crime series could affix it to the map, we got Trust. And Trust got Donald Sutherland, Brendan Fraser, and Hilary Swank, not to mention Duckface from Four Weddings and a Funeral. This is a lot of acting talent for this series, and it's a case that I knew absolutely nothing about before settling in to watch this. Toby, were you familiar with this case at all?
Just a tiny bit. I can't remember. It's like one of those, like the People's Almanac or something. Like when I was like 10, they had a thing about it, which I read and didn't really understand the family dynamic aspect of things. So I didn't know a ton, but I knew about the ear and I knew about the I'm not paying a cent.
Right. I really didn't know anything. The way that the series is structured, we got three screeners. I did watch all three. All three of these were directed by Danny Boyle. Slumdog Millionaire, Trainspotting, that guy. A little showily directed, in my opinion, although mostly I was okay with that. But the way it seems to be structured is that each sort of character in this drama, which is both crime drama and familial, you know, Freudian drama, gets a spotlight. So J. Paul Prime and his literal harem of like girlfriends of varying ages, and cheapness, like he writes everything down in a notebook that he spends, including the paper. He's the focus of the first episode. The second episode is really more about Brendan Fraser's character, Chase, Fletcher Chase, who is this Texan who goes looking for Paul III. And the third episode is about how this kidnapping sort of came to be from J. Paul III's perspective. Did you, how many episodes did you watch, Toby?
I watched all three of those.
Okay. Did you think that that was successful? That sort of, I mean, it's not really Rashomon, but like this, you know, various main characters getting a focus.
In addition to the different characters getting the focus, I felt like the tone of the different episodes was quite different. So the first one, which was is more the family drama, and with Donald Sutherland as the elder Getty, who is really a piece of work.
Yeah,
that's, so there's a little bit of satire there, I thought. But for the most part, it was sort of soap opera-ish. And then the second one, like, it was hard to take seriously at all. There's this, like, Brendan Fraser talking to the camera at the beginning and the end. I thought some of it was definitely sort of played for laughs. And the third is fairly dark. It's sort of follows the younger Getty. As he sort of realizes he's in trouble, and then tries to come up with a way to get out of the trouble, and which is by faking his kidnapping, but it turns out that it's not really all that fake when push comes to shove.
Yeah. There were, well, let's start with the first episode and this, portrait of, the famous original J. Paul Getty, which I think maybe is a little longer than it necessarily needs to be, but also definitely gives you a sense of what it's like to have to operate in that family. Like there are several scenes in which servants are surprised that Paul, who has sort of arrived in a last ditch effort to get some money from his grandfather to pay his debts, drug debts, basically, are like surprised that he thanks them and is nice and not the sort of like abusive, manipulative jackass. And then there's this like breakfast table scene. Well, all right, let's play clip two. The character who brings up King Lear is like this weird clip springer guy whose apparent function in the household is to read J. Paul the first porn so that he can get it up to have sex with his like 25-year-old Penelope Cruz twin girlfriend. Does that sound right? Did he do anything else?
Work if he can get it.
Yeah. I mean, it was high class erotica, I guess. Here's clip two.
So, which of you loves me best?
King Lear. Very good, Paul, very good.
What?
King Lear, the play. Shakespeare.
Ah.
Well, William Shakespeare wrote a tragedy called King Lear about an old king who divides up his kingdom between his daughters according to their love.
An old king? Old?
I'm not suggesting you. I'm not so old, I suppose. It's some strange play. It's not his best.
Overrated Shakespeare. Though, his will amused me. He left his wife, his second best bid. To whom should I leave my second best bid? Along with $1 billion, of course.
Yeah, it's pretty clear based on the faces on most of the girlfriends that this is like a daily occurrence. He's like, right. Who loves me best? Compete for my love. And then basically get nothing.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of a strange scene in that I wasn't sure. Like, if he actually did that, that's one thing. But it seemed like sort of a shortcut to showing how manipulative he was without actually having to do like the hard work of like actually showing it in action. It was just like, I'm just going to say it.
Yeah.
And get that out of the way. So that was a little, I didn't think that was one of the stronger parts of the episode, I guess.
Yeah. I'm, I am enjoying this performance from Donald Sutherland, who is clearly having a ball and hamming it up. And I'm also enjoying Brendan Fraser's performance, although there's some, I don't understand why he's the only character who gets a direct address to camera. And I also don't understand why there was this long speech about some years that evoke memories instantly. And then, like, it just seemed like, who wrote this and why wasn't it cut? Like, this is
exactly,
this is for the page, not the screen. He does a great job with it, to his credit, until he got around to insulting the year of my birth. I actually almost didn't notice how bad the writing was. Let's hear clip three.
1969, a personal favorite. Buzz Aldrin, slow waltzing his way across the gray old moon with a whole lot of love. What a year for mankind. But 1973, what can you say about that mousy-haired in-between girlfriend of a year? Too old for the swinging 60s? Too young for disco? It was the year that America finally admitted that $1 billion of firepower could not beat back a bunch of dollar-a-day commies.
I don't know. My mom seemed to enjoy watching the Watergate hearings while I was sleeping all day, but, like, you're wearing a Texan flag neckerchief in Rome, sir. What? Who is this for? The speech.
Right. Yeah, that's brutal. I mean, that, it just, it calls attention to itself, and it's not that clever. So,
yeah, that was, I did enjoy his little throwaway, like his crappy Italian pronunciation. I actually cut. I'm going to skip ahead to clip five because the grazie just cracked me up, and I think I'm going to keep this clip forever.
Welcome to Rome.
Grazie.
Grazie.
Yeah. Sure. He does a great sort of American, like, totally. I guess he's, it's not so much that he's not self-aware, it's that he thinks that being, like, acting unself-aware is to his advantage. But that's a very, like, he does that really well. And it's like, in that episode, there are a fair number of fairly funny scenes of him interacting with Italians and just being like, I'm an American, god damn it.
And I think that this actor, and we'll link it in the show notes, but there was a GQ profile going around last month about, like, where's this guy been? But he, and I'm sad to say that I've seen School Ties enough times to kind of have a theory about this, which is that this guy is, like, just physically bigger and takes up more space than most actors. Like, if you've ever seen School Ties, like, he's just kind of looming over everyone except, like, Cole Hauser. But there's something about, like, being a big guy and the just unconscious confidence that comes with that, that I think he, and now that he's got that middle-aged spread, which, no shade, me too, but between the big hat and the just his bulk, I think that he uses that really well with this character, that he's just like, you know, I don't really understand how things are done here and I don't have to care that much because I'm a big guy.
Yep.
But yeah, in episode two, meanwhile, back at home, J. Paul II, who has had his own problems with both J. Paul Prime and with drug debts and whatnot. Once J. Paul III has been kidnapped, number two does not exactly have the unqualified emotional support of his father, nor has he ever, as you can hear in clip four.
Timely intervention of yours, warning me of your son's drug addiction.
Oh, well,
in my experience, and we know in yours, funding a drug habit only encourages further abuse.
Yes, yes, exactly.
No one suspects that if you had not shown me that magazine, I would not have withheld the money. He would have repaid his debt, and he would not have been kidnapped.
dum, 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 dum. Consequences.
What, this is my fault?
I meet Fletcher Chase, my head of security. My son, the boy's father, unable to travel to Italy due to an outstanding arrest warrant for possession of drugs or manslaughter, I forget which.
I mean, he's horrible, but then I think we are supposed to, like, not sympathize with him, but I think we are supposed to be on Senior's side, since Junior does seem like kind of this feckless ball of resentment. But on the other hand, who wouldn't be?
Yeah. I mean, Junior's a worm, but like,
yeah,
it's, I can't imagine his upbringing. Like, all those kids, like, are drug addicts and, you know, emotionally stunted. And there is, like, there's this weird, you know, and again, I wonder if this is accurate or whether it's just for the show, but where the elder Getty kind of takes a shine to his grandson and, like, flies him out to an oil rig and, like, gets it in his head that despite the fact that this kid looks like a blonde Jim Morrison, that he's going to, like, be the heir. You know, he's going to run Getty Oil. And he's going to bypass his, you know, son to go to his grandson. And, you know, I like didn't buy that on so many different levels that it made me think that that probably wasn't accurate and that it's mostly for the drama, you know, but
Or that it felt to me, I didn't mind it so much, but it felt to me like, it was like a character development thing, like a economy of character development, where they're showing both that J. Paul Sr. doesn't respect any of his actual kids and doesn't like them. And there's no love lost because a lot of these now grown up people never really even lived with this guy. I think he had five wives and there was one who, like, held up one of the divorces to the extent that, like, he did have a bunch of other girlfriends living there. Like, I think that is accurate. But it also develops, Paul, the kidnappee, and, makes you, sort of not, like, respect him exactly, but it also, you know, puts him in enough contrast to his grandfather that you're on his side, even when you start to doubt per the writing that he's innocent in all of this. And, you know, I think the show is doing a good job of giving you enough perspectives that it's not entirely clear for a while how you're supposed to feel about the kid. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and maybe part of this is just sort of my personal, like, feeling about these kinds of things rather than how the show's trying to make us feel. But the fact that basically this kid needs $6,000, like, desperately, that's pretty clear. And that Getty won't give it to him when he's worth, like, whatever. I mean, this is like something you lose in the couch. That to me is, like, so beyond the pale about how you would treat, like, a member of your family or just anybody, you know, that it's hard. Like, my sympathy was definitely with the kid there. And I find it completely, like, inexplicable and unforgivable, the attitude was of, like, I really liked you until I found out that you posed in Playgirl, and so I'm
or like $6,000. I think the real issue is that he was wearing an Enjoy Cocaine T-shirt,
right?
Which, right. Like, all right. I mean, yeah.
So I googled that. I was like, is this real? Like, this 14 or 15 year old kid, like, posed nude in a enjoy cocaine t-shirt for some like softcore porn magazine.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find anything about it.
I also Googled it and I couldn't either. This is another thing that I had a little bit of an issue with, is that I really like the actor who's playing J. Paul III. Harris Dickinson is his name, and he's very charming and sort of is asked to do a lot of like kind of on the nose things to locate us in the story that he does really well. Like he's very winning, but he is not playing as almost 16 to me at all. And at times it's taking me out of the story. Like, I don't know. I know it was the 70s and things were different and it was Italy and things are different, as we'll hear in an upcoming clip. But it's not like he looks 30, but he looks 20, not almost 16. Were you having an issue with that?
The most shocking moment in the entire thing is when he's about to be kidnapped and he says, "I'm not even 16 yet."
And you're like, in dog years?
Hold on a second.
What? Yeah.
It's like, no, you're totally like at least 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he reminded me of you know, various like wealthy kids I knew in college who sort of had that same kind of, you know, knowing that there's only so far you can kind of fall and having that sort of, that sort of casual and kind of enjoying things without like fear of major consequences.
Yeah. And so, also the utter disregard for just like taking care of your shit. Like the first that we see of him is his, is him from like the knees down getting out of the car at, J. Paul Prime's estate. And he's wearing these, like, you know, more hole than shoe pair of Chuck Taylors and these just ratty, torn up bell-bottom jeans. And it just made me think of, like, all the super rich kids that I went to university with and how it was, like, the same pair, like, one Patagonia, one pair of khakis, one pair of jeans. That was the whole semester. Apparently, like, that got them through Choate, and it was going to get them through college too. And it was like, it was always so strange to me that I was like, I don't know, like another pair of khakis, maybe just for funsies.
The other thing that kind of threw me out of he's 15 was there's a scene where there's this awful scene where he's supposed to be on drugs and he's like dancing around by himself.
Yeah. I mean, talk about Jim Morrison.
Like,
nope.
Like nobody who's on drugs actually acts. And and he goes to a bar and there's this like 20 something beautiful waitress. And he's like, "Is it okay if I kiss you?" And I'm like, if that kid's really 15, she's going to look at him and be like, "What is your problem, kid?" but not, he's like a 20-year-old model looking guy. So she's like, "Sure."
Yeah. And I mean, there's also the whole relationship with the gemelle, like the twins, which is like
the twins. And then his buddy with a mustache.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is like, it's very Fellini, but I also appreciated this note from the policeman that Chase is trying to get to help him. In the second episode, here's clip 6.
Inspector.
Chase, in Italy, kidnapping is seen as a personal matter. In due course, a ransom will be demanded, and after a short period of negotiation, the boy will be released. The police get involved, and everything becomes much more dangerous.
Now, here, it's just a business deal with threats.
You know, the Red Brigade, the Mafia, the communists, strikes, student violence. These are busy time for the police.
I guess.
I just like that exchange. It sort of reminded me, too, of there's this book by one of the founders of profiling John Douglas. It's called The Cases That Haunt Us. And when he's talking about the Lindbergh kidnapping and how many like dumb leads they followed initially, he's like, these didn't seem dumb at the time because kidnapping was big business in the Depression. Like it happened all the time.
Right.
And it wasn't necessarily that big a deal. Like for a kid to be kidnapped was a little unusual, but this was like SOP for gangs to make quick money. And, you know, most of the time people returned unharmed, not big ransom. And that just reminded me of that. And also, again, of D.B. Cooper, who was like, it's just business. I want the money. I want you to drop me over this forest. Everything's going to be cool.
Yeah, there's a cool book called We Own the Skies, which is about – it's like a history of hijackings. And that in the 60s, like the airlines were just like, well, that's just kind of the price of business.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Every once in a while, well, a plane will get hijacked. It'll fly to Cuba. We'll, you know, let the people off, pay the ransom, and we'll get our plane back. And you know, and people like flew with guns, you know, it wasn't a problem to take a gun on your bag. And then it actually turned out that when they banned guns on in the cabins of planes, like all these mafia guys who used to fly from New York to Miami wouldn't do it anymore because they didn't want to be away from their guns. So that's when they started driving.
Really?
Strange little. Yeah. Anyway, the book is called We Own the Skies. It's really good. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, that's really funny that you mentioned that because it is sort of interesting. Like when you look at like the 30s and the Depression and this sort of era of like, well, you know, there are no jobs. There is no manufacturing. We are going to have to create jobs and like kidnapping. Sure. And then you see a similar thing in the 70s that's like there's this like there's stagflation, of course, but also this kind of like feeling that the government can't save you, and not the malaise exactly, but kind of the same. It's like, all right, well, kidnapping, you can't really do that anymore. Let's try skyjacking.
Right.
So yeah, I'm not degreed up enough to sort of really draw any parallels or make any grand pronouncements about that. But I'm definitely going to check that book out. And I did find that phrasing amusing. Like, kidnapping is considered a personal matter. Like, I'm just imagining Kermit drinking tea. Like, none of my business. Okay.
Right. And then Aldo Moro was kidnapped around this, or maybe it was a few years later. Like, the former prime minister, and he was by the Red Brigades.
Right.
And I believe he was killed rather than released.
Yeah. Italy's a strange place. I feel like I'm not sure that, we can comprehend like the sort of instability of institutions in some ways.
Right.
But yes, please correct us on any and all of this on Twitter, listeners. We're at Blotter Presents. One last clip from this section in which Chase is explaining to J. Paul III's estranged mother, Gail. She's estranged from both him and his father, J. Paul II. She's now married to some other geese, who's a complete dick. I think J. Paul was a handful, got kicked out of a bunch of boarding schools and was like living it up and trading paintings for food at a cafe. I think that did actually happen. But Gail, played by Hilary Swank, is sort of in denial about her son's possible agency in this situation in clip 7.
Probably nothing. It is nothing. So Paul got obsessed with some movie. That's what he does. Fletcher, he wouldn't do this. He just wouldn't do this. I know my son.
That's exactly what Paul did. It couldn't be more clear.
since Thursday, I have been in the hands of kidnappers. Right there, Thursday. 2 days later, he turns up at the Treetops nightclub. He dances himself stupid. He buys the waitress a drink, and then he leaves in a hurry. Kidnap Thursday, you fear for his life Friday, partying Saturday. That's a very lax kidnapping schedule, even for Italy.
That can't be right.
That's a good line, but this is also a pretty well-written scene. It's kind of processy. I think the show is good at kind of making this a family drama, but also doing the mystery parts well. And so I found that compelling. I think Hilary Swank is good in this. She needed a chapstick in that scene, but I thought she was good. Your thoughts?
Yeah. No, she's good. I mean, she's playing... Her character does not have a very good ability to read men. Like, she's married to
that was very diplomatic.
Asses, and her son is, you know... It's not really a ne'er-do-well, but he's... You know, he's in need of like some parenting, which she does not provide. But yeah, I think she's good. I mean, I thought, you know, the acting is good. The acting in some cases is really good. The direction is better than what you'd expect for this kind of thing. And it does, you know, it draws attention to itself sometimes. Like in the opening scene where they have that one extended shot where like somebody like the camera like dives into the pool and is underwater and then comes back out and follows some people and eventually ends up at this garage where one of the Gettys commits suicide, I guess.
Yeah. Using a barbecue fork while four women are shrieking at him from outside to stop. Right. I mean, it can be a lot, this show. And Alan Sepinwall, in his review at Up Rocks, was a little concerned that, you know, once Danny Boyle departs, from the director's chair, like we weren't given screeners after that. So, and he also felt the third episode was the weakest of the three. I don't agree. I thought that the way they kaleidoscoped that timeline was pretty cool. I think this Dickinson kid is good. I'm interested to see how it unfolds. I am a little concerned that this is maybe a 6-episode joint and not 10, but I'm going to keep up with it and find out. Are you going to keep watching?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's definitely, it's the kind of thing I would continue watching. Like I would recommend it to people. I think it's interesting enough that at least through the first three, like I'd be looking forward to 4, and I don't know if it drops off when Danny Boyle leaves. And I also, you know, it just seems like there's so many kind of themes and issues that can be, you know, addressed or have a point of view on. And it's not clear at this point whether that's going to happen. And if it is just kind of playing it straight, I think that's sort of a missed opportunity.
What do you mean? Like continuing to, like if episode 4 is from the perspective of Gail?
Well, I just think not. About like, I think about more this idea of like, sort of insane greed by people who have more money than they can ever know what to do with.
Right.
And sort of assumptions that people like that can make about the way the world works. Some of the political stuff that was going on in Italy during that time, I think.
Yeah. I would not mind an episode from the perspective of that detective that Chase was talking to, or like anyone on the Italian side, because apparently
it's just
sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Well, it's just at a time when, you know, it's kind of up in the air whether the communists were going to, you know, have some kind of power in Italy. The Red Brigades were certainly active and violent. And so this idea of this like super wealthy American kid who's sort of, you know, I mean, he's having fun in a sort of irresponsible way and is sort of naive about sort of the greater societal forces around him and how that ends up in this kidnapping. You know, I think that that's an interesting thing that could be looked at. So far it hasn't, and I don't know if it would or not.
Yeah. Well, and it's also interesting to me, there were a couple of scenes in which I found myself thinking about Amanda Knox and just the difference between what a Getty's experience of putting your like naive trust in A, your family's money, and B, law enforcement in this situation is compared with Amanda Knox's, where her family doesn't have Getty money, obviously, and then her trust in law enforcement is grievously misplaced. So it made me think of it a few times, because for someone like, you know, for this kid, the world is literally his oyster. And for someone like Amanda Knox, it's, you know, danger lurks around every corner. So, yeah, I mean, I'll be interested to see what they do with it with another, you know, 7 episodes. If they keep strictly to this point of view thing, I mean, that could end up being really cool, but we've seen 3 big points of view already, so I'm not sure how that's going to turn out.
You're going to get some random people towards the end, if that's the case.
I know, like the lion that J. Paul the First turns loose at that party. Teresa. She's like, I don't know, they feed me well. So yeah, yes, exactly. Once again, Trust is on FX. It's on Sunday nights at, I assume, some hour in which they can show people doing it and a lot of swears. So I'm going to say 10, but check your local listings. Well, speaking of people who may or may not have arranged their own kidnappings, it's time for our cold case section. Patty Hearst, of course, the sort of ne plus ultra of this kind of case. We decided to look at it via The Lost Tapes, which is a Smithsonian series that I think I reviewed on previously.tv when it first dropped. I'm a pretty big fan of it because it only really uses like archival stuff. There's no voiceover. The Chirons don't get too hysterical. You don't have, you know, that Selwyn, what's his name? That guy is on like literally every American mafia show. You don't have like the whorish talking head people. It's just what was going on at the time, which it can sometimes be a little dry and they repeat pictures, but it's generally pretty good. In case listeners are not familiar, here's the case file. In early 1974, newspaper heiress Patricia Hearst was yanked screaming out of her Berkeley apartment. A very short time later, she was communicating to her parents and the world that she'd joined forces with her captors, the Symbionese Liberation Army. Lost Tapes, working entirely from contemporaneous footage and reports, reconstructs her year-and-a-half-long jaunt through the underbelly of radical chic and calls into question just how Stockholm her syndrome really was. So I have that Jeffrey Toobin book, American Heiress, sitting in my to-read pile. It's very close to the top. I'm tempted to jump it ahead. I thought his OJ book was very good. And now I am really much more interested in this case, having watched The Lost Tapes, because I think I thought the received wisdom about this is that she really was brainwashed. Having watched this now, it seems like she was much more instrumental in everything than she was letting on, And only if by brainwashed you mean she was 19 and was like back on her sophomore bullshit. So right. now I'm interested. How much did you know about this kidnapping, first of all, before we watched this?
So actually, in sort of conjunction with the book American Heiress, Tubin did a podcast, which is basically just somebody interviewing him.
Right.
But for, 4 hours or something.
Oh, yeah, so yeah. We talked about that. Did you listen to that at all?
I did. And it was, it's not, it's just an interview, basically.
It's a long
interview. So it's not really much of a produced podcast, but it's super interesting. I mean, he knows everything about the story. And he's a very good talker. So I thought that was really good. And so I kind of felt like I had a pretty good handle on sort of the facts and what happened. I do think, unless I missed it, he didn't get too much into, how things kind of worked with Patty Hearst and how she came from being kidnapped to being, an armed revolutionary. And it seemed, my sense was from, the interviews with her afterwards and just kind of the way she sounded in the fact that just a few years later, she was like back in the bourgeois mentality and getting married to some guy. She just seemed like immensely influenceable,
Like
if she was around a bunch of people who felt a certain way, she'd be like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting also. I'm going to play clip 8, which is one of her early cassette communiques with her parents, where sort of the transformation is, if not like it's well underway, but there's a bratty phrasing right in the middle that just I found very striking. So here's clip 8.
These people aren't just a bunch of nuts. They're perfectly willing to die for what they're doing. And I would appreciate it if everyone would just calm down and not try to find me and not be making identifications, because they're not only endangering me, but they're endangering themselves. It's really up to you to make sure that these people don't jeopardize my life by charging in and doing stupid things.
I mean,
chill out, man.
I'd really appreciate it if everyone would just like chill out. Okay. Oh, you're a Hearst. You chill out.
Right.
I thought that was great. I also, go ahead.
Well, I just, I don't know about this for sure. It's just kind of an impression I have is that, in the 60s with like the Weathermen and then probably like this with Patty Hearst and like when you have these, fairly privileged, or in Patty Hearst's case, very privileged white people suddenly being exposed to how different and depressing and unfair, the lives of particularly African Americans or just poor Americans are, that for certain people that radicalizes them. Like,
sure.
It's like when the Buddha like left his palace and then suddenly it was like, holy shit, they're poor people.
yeah.
So that's what makes, so if you have an impressionable, 19-year-old who kind of finds yourself suddenly with a bunch of radicals, including, tough African-American ex-cons, like this Sinque guy.
Who really did not need a revolutionary name when he was already named DeFries.
Yeah.
Which is like the coolest fucking
DeFries
name
is perfect.
Ever. Yeah.
Yeah. And Sinque just, it sounds like you're mispronouncing something in Spanish.
But, yeah, kind of.
Yeah. So I, you know, that seemed to me to be fairly clear, and that if the way that you have to process that is she was brainwashed, like, I don't even like the whole idea of brainwashing. Like, is that even like sort of scientifically accepted? Like, that could happen. I mean, like, what does that exactly mean? I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's like, I guess that is one term for it, but it's like, it seems like a very sort of flip. Like, it's not like the real Argo of it. It's just like, oh, she was totally brainwashed. It's more like, you know, when you first start dating a person and all of a sudden you're like, well, actually such and so says this about the other thing. And it's like, all right, well, that's influence. It's exposure and it's annoying, but it usually passes. So I don't know.
Right.
But I mean, in a later clip, I want to point out a contrast that I feel like I'm hearing in her voice. But first, I would like to point out that I kind of admire the SLA's commitment to melodramatic, process-y cassette drops using local clergy. Clip 9.
A caller said to pick up a key taped in a telephone booth in the garage of the Hilton Hotel. The key fit a locker in the airline terminal a block away. Inside the locker was a tape cassette of Patricia Hearst's voice.
Dad, Mom, I'm making this tape to let you know that I'm still okay and to explain a few things, I hope.
I mean, she sounds so, first of all, that's hilarious. Like, I don't know. They definitely had a talent for not branding exactly, but like to make the story more dramatic and keep it front and center for their concerns, even though there was like a manhunt in progress for these people. Right. I don't know, like taping a, if I'd been aware of the story, I was, you know, a year old, so I was not, but if I had been aware of the story, I would have thought it was cool that like keys were being taped to things and there's like a scavenger hunt for clues and whatnot.
Well, I think a bunch of those, I say a bunch, there weren't that many people to begin with, but there's a small group of them were drama students from some college. I'm not going to remember which one it is, but Tubin does talk about that on the podcast.
I want to say Claremont. I don't remember either.
Yeah.
No, they definitely had a flair for that. But as time went on, like there was they sort of, law enforcement converges on the headquarters, or a headquarters at like safe house. And they, I think, tried to smoke bomb it, but then a fire started. Almost everyone in this little army, which was like 9 people, was killed. Not Patty Hearst and not the Harrises, but everyone else, including DeFries. And then she kind of, I think she just disappeared for like almost a year, which is, again, like they're good at this. They're good at being those people who fuck shit up and go underground. Like I kind of have to respect that from an efficaciousness standpoint. But as the tapes keep coming in, she sounds like not like a different person, but like a more possessed, mature person in this clip, which is our last clip, clip 10.
I've never been forced to say anything on any tape, nor have I been brainwashed, drugged, tortured, hypnotized, or in any way confused. Stephen, I've changed, grown. I've become conscious and can never go back to the life we led before. Love doesn't mean the same thing to me anymore. My love has expanded as a result of my experiences to embrace all people, a love that comes from the knowledge that no one is free until we are all free. I have been given the choice of 1, being released in a safe area, or 2, joining the forces of the Symbionese Liberation Army and fighting for my freedom and the freedom of all oppressed people. I have chosen to stay and fight.
I mean, on the one hand, I guess you could say that she sounds zombified in that clip. I don't agree with that. I think she just sounds like 10 years older. Like, she just sounds like a much older person.
Yeah, she's just reading something. I mean, you're not.
But she has to have been reading before. Like, as the clips go on, like, as the episode goes on and she's reading, like, the SLE demanded that there be this, like, food giveaway that turned into a total debacle because it wasn't planned terribly well. And she sent a tape about that and how her parents had fucked it up. And eventually her parents just stopped trying. You will see in on our social media a particularly hilarious snap of her mother just making this face in response to a certain tape that's like, I'm done. But she, as the tapes continue, it seems like the timbre of her voice like changes and gets deeper and more authoritative. Maybe I'm just making that up in my head, but
I think that's right.
It's a strange evolution to me in her. And then, you know,
yeah,
she's arrested.
You think about the stuff that she experienced.
Yeah.
You know, after like being a little wealthy kid to suddenly like hanging out with armed revolutionaries and robbing banks and having a bunch of her friends be killed and then going underground for a year. Like, the idea that you would come out of that without changing.
Yeah.
Seems a little unrealistic.
Well, and evidently she weighed less than 90 pounds when she was finally found. But yikes. Then she sort of like does her time. Her sentence is commuted. She marries this guy. They were together, I think, until he passed away a few years ago. And now she's like a dog trainer or dog breeder in Connecticut, which, how much more like heiress bougie can you get? And like they're toy dogs too. They're like Shih Tzus, literally. All right, go ahead, Patricia. But yeah, I don't think the Lost Tapes takes a position on how culpable she was. So I'm finding it hard to make up my own mind about it, but I thought that was something that was good and effective about the show. That they're just sort of like, well, here's what we knew. Here was the coverage. Here's John Chancellor talking about it on the nightly news, and draw your own conclusion. So I thought that was cool. And I think that's something that this show generally does pretty well. Would you agree?
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. I hadn't like seen any of those before. And it does, I thought it was very effective of sort of evoking the time, and just, you know, what people's attitudes were towards what was going on then, without, you know, the lens of now, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought it was really good. And especially right after listening to that podcast, it kind of, you know, put some faces to names and kind of fleshed it out a little bit.
Yeah. So the Lost Tapes, I think they may rerun it occasionally. Again, that's the Smithsonian Channel, which is up there in the 130s on Spectrum Systems. Check your local listings. You can also purchase it on Amazon. All right. I think that about wraps it up for this episode, but my March Madness enduring friend, I believe that you may have a related item in your plug. Where else can listeners find you? And what is special about that podcast as of late?
Oh, yeah. So I'm on Crime Writers On, and we just today, or the day that we're recording this, won this like podcast tournament that was essentially like a you know, audience engagement type thing where you get people to vote for your podcast against other podcasts. And there were 64 at the beginning, and we ended up winning it, surprisingly.
I am really not surprised at all, frankly. That was
it's nice that the really big ones had no idea what was going on, so they didn't like do anything about it.
Yeah, I did hear you guys talking about how that was your theory, but you know what? Momentum's momentum.
Yeah,
I will take it. Yeah, that's great. Congrats. I'm with it. I voted for you guys.
Yeah, it was fun. Oh, thank you.
Anywhere else?
Yeah, I do. We have a very sort of active audience on social media and stuff. So it was kind of cool to have everybody pulling in the same direction.
Who was your opponent in the last?
This American Life.
Oh. Yeah.
And they did not know it was going on.
Take the lap. Take the victory. Right.
Exactly.
Like, don't poke that bear. Definitely not.
Right. So again, it's Crime Writers On. We talk about crime and pop culture.
And it has bested This American Life. So folks, if you haven't started listening, get in now.
Jump on the bandwagon.
Toby, thank you for joining us once again. Coming up on future episodes of The Blotter Presents, Ice-T's foray into true crime in Ice Cold Blood, and yet another take on The Staircase. I think there's new episodes of The Staircase, too, coming this summer. I'm very excited, and we will be here for it. Got something to add to The Blotter Presents case files? Visit our forums at previously.tv/forums or hit me on social media at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. My guest has been Toby Ball. You can find him on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. We will talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.